Obviously got those corrected now. Well, for the recording, we've called the meeting to order. Welcome to the June 30th, 2022 commission meeting. This is a special meeting. And so let's move on to the business, to our items. First item is comments from the public. T, do we have comments from the public?
Yes. If anyone from the public would like to make a comment at this time, please raise your hand or state your name. Bethany?
Hey. Hi, my name is Bethany Rondo, and I'm just calling about just the fee increase for price increase for the meter hookup. And my husband and I, we had a chance to send the commissioners an email. I don't know if you guys had a chance to receive that or review it. But it was something that we sent out 2 days ago.
Have the commissioners seen an email from Ms. Falcona?
Yes, I saw it.
Okay.
I don't think I have. What was the subject?
It was about meter hookup price increase. And we sent it to Rick, Purser, Mr. Will, and Jim.
Now, this is a business meter hookup, is that right?
Yeah, so, in summary, Justin, my husband and I, we're building a 26,400 square foot building up Deer Park Road. So we are right next to the FedEx building. We also own the three other cannabis grows in town. And so we're moving one of our locations to this building that we are building. And the fee increase would essentially increase our cost by around $43,000.
Let me interject. We limit comments to 3 minutes, so you might want to.
Okay. So pretty much what we're asking is that you guys are willing to let us do a deposit or pay for the entire hookup now, just because the 30-day heads up grace period is just really a short window for the size of the grow that we're doing, size of the building that we're building, and we've been a great customer of PUD for the last, 10 years. So we're just hoping that you guys will give us a little grace in that inflation, because like you guys are experiencing, we're experiencing the same thing, and that supplies are really hard to come by. We ordered stuff 9 months ago, and we're still waiting on things to come in.
Okay, thank you. Staff will make note of that and respond.
Yes, I have made note of that, and I'm also sending a chat to Bethany to please forward that email to me. If you would, I'll send my email address in the chat, Bethany.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bethany. Do we have others, T?
I am not seeing any raised hands. Are there any others who would like to speak at this time?
Okay.
Not hearing any, Will.
All right, thank you. Agenda revisions. Do we have agenda revisions?
None today, Will.
Great. All right, approval of the consent agenda. This is information that was sent out to the commission earlier, and so we can discuss it, have questions, or make a motion.
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for June the 30th, 2022. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Moving on to business items. Our first business item is transformer update and proposed capacity charge. And we have a resolution, 224122. Authorizing additions to the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and rescinding resolution 223622. John, I believe you have that one.
Yes, sir. Well, yes, we have given presentations on transformers for the last several meetings. And last meeting, the board authorized procurement of emergency procurement of a number of transformers. And I'm pleased to report that of that order, we have received 56 units of the 76 that were went out for order on, plus 15 overhead transformers in addition to that. We have 20 transformers that are scheduled for delivery next week. We expect to have a total of 76 25 kVA pad-mounted transformers that we didn't have previously. And when you add these to the 17 units we procured in May, as well as the 6 units the City of Port Angeles provided us, that is a number that will allow us to provide service for customers who paid up until at least May of this year, those waiting for services that we didn't have transformers for. So we expect in the month of July to take these single bushing non-standard transformers that are dead-end transformers for a single customer so that we can replace the transformers in the field at those locations to bring back into stock dual bushing standard transformers that are readily usable for the customers. So we anticipate starting in probably early August to start providing service to that backlog. Now the I think I'm going to share a screen real quick just to give you an idea. Okay, this is one of the transformers we received. As you can see, it's considerably smaller than the pad transformers we used. Our lineman this week tried to figure out the best way to install these transformers on our standard pads. And they did come up with a creative way to do so by turning the unit sideways. And we can bring up the primary cable and the elbow and plug that in and take the bug legs, secondaries, back down. So this will work. So it will not be a complicated change out. We don't have to put any metal plates on the pad to ensure the public doesn't have access to it. So we think this will go pretty quick. So we'll change out the infield transformers with these units at existing locations, at least 70 of them, maybe as many as 76. And then we'll bring those back in and they'll be available for new services. And we may even have some availability for new requests, which we stopped taking in early May, to supply some of the future requirements. But probably not enough to take us up and make us completely whole, and certainly not enough to take us through the months ahead unless we start receiving some of the orders that we have on order that's been greatly delayed since January and March of this year. So we're making some progress. We appreciate the board approving that resolution to make this emergency procurement. And we'll start taking new service requests here in August. And those that we have already received payment for, we expect to install those services starting August 1st, or the first part of August. Now, we had a public comment from Bethany, and this is in regards to this issue on the capacity charge that we proposed last time for a commission review for new service requests. And Exanthius presented that last meeting for your consideration, and these are the numbers we're talking about. For most customers, residential, we'll be looking at a $1,200 charge associated with a 240-volt one-phase service, and there'll be some at 1632, the larger homes that might have 320 amp service, and that's what we're looking at for residential. Now, Bethany is doing a very large service, one of the very largest service we do in our areas, 2,000 amp service, 480 volt three phase. And you see here on the lower right, that is the assessed charge for those large services. Unfortunately, for Bethany, they're having trouble getting the switchgear in and being positioned for any kind of load by the time these charges would go into effect. And if you recall from last meeting, these charges are intended to assess new connecting customers, the additional unanticipated transformer cost, as opposed to a general rate increase for all customers, for what is anticipated to be a 2.3% rate impact simply for transformer escalation. So, for some of our customers, it's very detrimental, especially for the largest customers, which is a considerable amount of money. But I will say that the transformer that we will be installing for that service is 1,000 kVA. The stock transformer that we're intending to use for that will be on the order of, procured a few years ago, about $21,000, $22,000. And the order we placed early this year for that stock replacement is about $62,000, $63,000 a year. So the transformer escalation on that size transformer is pretty consistent with the service size that we're installing. So we're going to incur that cost when the transformer is received and paid for. So just for full information, that's what we're proposing that you vote on today. And any comments?
John, this transformer you're putting in, is that temporary and you're going to pull it out and put another transformer there after we have standby, the one you temporarily use and then take out? Is that
negative. What we're doing is we keep a limited stock on the very largest transformers we use, the 1,000 kVA transformers. And when we actually have one on the yard that's allocated for a job, a planned job, as opposed to an emergency replacement due to a failure, we have to backfill that stock item so we'll have a spare. So we don't want to maintain a huge inventory of these because it's been quite a few years, several years, since we've even set a new 1,000 kVA transformer. But we have to have one for future use if there's a failure in one of the transformers already in the field. And we have probably six such transformers.
So back to your other transformers. So we have enough to satisfy the backlog of people that have paid.
Correct.
We have. We're also building up our stock of transformers. And have we increased that stock yet? Are we able to increase it with, given the market, what's going on in the market today?
No, in all honesty, we have 17 plus 6, 23 plus 56 and plus 20 more we're going to get next week. That's going to make us good for emergencies and the backlog of transformers, plus a number, perhaps 10, 15 new customers, once we start taking new service orders. The problem is we're going to get inundated with service orders because we haven't been taking them since early May. Plus, the word is out that we do have trouble getting 25 kVA transformers. And I'm sure that the first day we open up new requests, those transformers will be already allocated. One of the things we are doing next week is we're having the servicemen meeting, which includes all individuals who take service requests and designs, to ensure that we have an equitable and fair way of ordering these requests. And as part of that, there is a requirement that we be able to serve load, because we have some customers who are building next year wanting to get the transformer installed now to make sure that they are able to have service next year. And, of course, we do not have those transformers. So it'll be until we start receiving our normal transformer orders that were scheduled in January and March and May of this year, we will continue to operate at some deficit.
So delivery and cost of transformers is no easing of that we're seeing so far. The Builders Association nationally made a plea to the White House to use the defense procurement legislation to speed this along, but I guess there's been nothing that's come back from that.
Yes, and there's also been lobbying to relax the efficiency standards on transformers so that we take care of this emergency need. I don't think anything's been done on that as well. We are keeping an eye out for more canceled orders from other utilities that, you know, are electing not to pay the very high cost for these transformers. That picture I showed was a $6,700 transformer. That is, and that's a, I'm not going to call it a low quality. It's a design of a transformer that is very minimal, which is far from our normal standard 25 kV pad transformers. Yeah, we just procure that at a desperation.
Looks pretty wimpy to me, but okay.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions, comments? Okay, we have a motion here.
Okay, staff requests that the commission pass resolution number 2241-22, authorizing additions to the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and rescinding resolution 2236-22. This resolution introduces a new service capacity charge that will shift elevated transformer costs to customers requesting new service as opposed to existing ratepayers.
So do we have a motion?
Well, before we get to the motion, I would like to, this is Rick, I'd like to acknowledge that I recognize that this new capacity charge is going to affect our customers. But like I said last time, I would rather see a rate increase for those that are requesting new service or additional service rather than a rate increase for all customers. It's not what I prefer, but it feels more fair to me to charge those that are increasing their demand rather than to spread the cost over all the customers.
Yeah, you get no argument from me.
With that, I suggest that we approve resolution 2244-22. No, that's the wrong one, isn't it, John?
Yeah, 41.
It's 2241-22, authorizing additions to 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and rescinding resolution 2236-22.
Yeah, I second that motion with the same reservations that Rick had, but agree.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to pass resolution 2241-22, authorizing additions to the 2022 schedule of deposits and charges and rescinding resolution 2236-22. This resolution introduces a new service capacity charge that will shift elevated transformer costs to customers requesting new service as opposed to existing ratepayers. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Our next item is resolution 2244-22, authorizing the district to purchase long lead time vehicles and equipment for 2023 and 2024 budget years. Terry?
Hi, guys. Everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. So I'm here today to ask that the board, upon recommendation of staff, pass resolution number 2244-22, granting district staff budget authorization to procure long lead time vehicles and equipment in advance of regular budget approval for years 2023 and 2024 for a not-to-exceed total purchase price of $1.1 million for 2023 and $1.1 million for 2024, not including sales tax. By ordering these long lead time vehicles and equipment now, we will receive these items closer to the budget year they'll be ordered for and should save the district money by procuring earlier. Even ordering now, we can expect to receive the long lead time vehicles and equipment, such as bucket trucks and derricks, in late 2024 or early 2025. 800-day build times are referenced, but they're not guaranteed. The only change from the normal process for ordering vehicles and equipment is that we are asking for budget authority to order these long lead time items now in the hopes of receiving them much closer to the years they are budgeted for. Previously, we waited until after the budget year approval to initiate orders. This year, we are asking to order quite a bit earlier. So thanks for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Terry, have you seen a uptick in the price for these items?
Yeah, so right now, we haven't seen a big uptick in the prices, but what we have seen is these long lead times, a budget price, but no guarantee on the delivery time or the price. And we have seen a couple of, just in the last couple things that we're just getting close to receiving from last year, we're seeing last minute increases, not real big ones yet, but, you know, $2,500 and $3,000.
Yeah, I would add that, yes, we've had procurement of big ticket items with allowed inflationary adjustments, even through our MRSC Source World procurement, which means we received a quote, but they're authorized to add an additional amount to cover inflationary increases.
So what is that amount now, and what do we predict it's going to be?
Well, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Sourcewell, I think they're looking at the CPI type stuff. They are putting limits on it. It's not like Transformers where they're quadrupling the price, but you're definitely seeing inflation since this time last year of close to 9%.
And I will say that we had one increase suggested to us on a back trailer that we just ordered. As once it was ready to be sent to us to be shipped, they contacted us and it was a Source World purchase. They told us that the price was going to increase $9,000, but we did our due diligence and actually got back to Source World and had them go through the process, and we did not realize that price increase in the end. We got it for the original price, and we'll continue to look at those things very closely.
So these are complete vehicles fit for service. They're not going to go to a outfit to add additional features or?
Yeah, so for the most part, that's true. This is, so for 2023, we're looking at getting a bucket truck, a 60-foot bucket truck, a 45-foot digger derrick, mini excavator, and a foreman's work truck. Those are all long lead time items right now. We will, from the manufacturer, the original bid, both the truck, the cab, the chassis, and the boom for it will all be put together at a facility. Then it'll come to us, and we will install the lights and our logos on the doors and the numbers and those things, and that'll prepare them for service.
Yeah, I was just wondering if taking it to this third party to fully outfit the vehicles, that they would run into long delivery times and be more delayed, but sounds like that's not the case.
We are running into that. Almost anywhere we're sending something to, we're seeing delays that we hadn't expected or seen before. But we're able to do most all of that, all of that stuff other than the armor coating we do still send out, but that's going quickly. But we're doing that in shop.
Okay, good.
Well, I appreciate the staff looking forward and trying to anticipate future delays. So you have my support on this.
Thank you.
So, do we have a motion for this resolution, 2244-22?
I move that we accept resolution 2244-22, authorizing the district to purchase long lead time vehicles and equipment for 2023 and 2024 budget years.
I second the motion.
All right, it's been moved and seconded for approval of resolution 2244-22, authorizing the district to purchase long lead time vehicles and equipment for 2023 and 2024 budget years. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Thank you very much.
All right, next item on our agenda is the BPA contract discussion. Not sure if we've had additional meetings, but anyway, anybody have anything on that?
Yes. I participated in Ryan's WAPAG meeting on Monday, I think it was. And I must admit, I am concerned about the contract in a couple of ways. On the system size, I'm hearing a lot of requests to increase significantly, at least significantly in my opinion, the generation that is allocated to the customers. Historically, in the Northwest, we've always done critical water planning. And clearly, global warming has thrown a monkey wrench into that. However, I still do believe that the firm, non-firm concepts still make a lot of sense. And the numbers that I'm hearing coming out of public power that wanting to increase the size of the system is such that I think it's going to put Bonneville in the position of having to go out into the market a heck of a lot more than they have in the past. And one of the things I noticed when I used to trade was that anytime Bonneville's in the market, it biases the market significantly. In other words, if Bonneville is out selling, the market drops 20-30%. If they're out buying, it increases 20-30-40%. And the numbers that Clark County has been throwing out there for the size they would like to see for the system, I believe is going to put Bonneville in a significant buying position. And I personally don't really know what the right number is, but I'm concerned with the size that I'm hearing some of the public power folks talk about with respect to the system size.
So as part of this, I'm hearing like Clark and a number of the larger utilities are talking about going to load following full requirements. Is that what's driving Bonneville to go more to market?
Well, I think it's that and the expected load growth that we are assuming is going to happen because of electric vehicles and CETA. You put all this on top of Bonneville, and the power has to come from somewhere. And if we really are getting into a global warming period, which all indications point in that direction, and we're using new water years now because we don't believe that historic water years are going to be reflective of what we see in the future, which tells me that the goal is to be expecting less from the hydro system, but at the same time, we're expecting Bonneville to increase the amount of energy and power that is being provided to the publics. You know, it just doesn't feel like it's lining up correctly, and we're putting Bonneville in a position of being in a big acquisition mode. And I think we just need to be careful and thoughtful as we move through this process.
Yeah, I'm sure we all attended that resource adequacy workshop put on by UTC, and good presentation by the Power and Conservation Council. And they are using climate change models rather than historical data, as is Bonneville. And so that's going to change the whole picture, I'm sure.
Hey, this is Sean Rick. Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Ryan sent out the Tier 1 system size augmentation and allocation draft proposal, and I could be wrong, but I remember going through. I don't remember him seeing him put any numbers in there as far as system size, just more of some math calculations on the contract high watermark. Do you have any issues in supporting his draft proposal? I think he's looking for comments back to him maybe next week.
Well, I've had problems with the everyone has to have the same contract. I think that there are some publics, or I expect that there will be some publics that would prefer to augment themselves rather than having Bonneville augment. So what I've been starting to advocate for is to at least consider the possibility of there being choices. In other words, and I think our utility would be in the one in the camp of saying, yes, we want Bonneville to go out there and augment for us. But there may be some of the larger publics, Seattle City Light, for instance, or Tacoma City Light. I don't know, for instance, or in particular, where each of those are, but I'm assuming that some of the larger utilities may want to choose to augment on their own. And I question whether the one size fits all is the right way to go. Yes, the paper didn't talk much about system size, but we all know that that's the issue out there that could prove to be, I think, the most divisive for public power.
This is John. I would agree with that. There are a couple things going on here. If you look at the number of utilities that have substantial headroom, some of the big utilities have a lot. Even Port Angeles has a lot due to the mill closure. But even when you consider that, when you shuffle it all out, you are going to be increasing the system size. And as time goes on and loads increase, if EVs take off, yes, I mean, you're going to have a growing system. Now, the actual proposal or paper or the addition or augmentation to the what was previously provided to BPA sets aside three formulations that will trigger system augmentation increase. And I believe, and I'm not entirely sure, it's really complicated, that there is a provision for customers to opt out and do their own augmentation, but it's still conflated because you have one system and you have one cost basis. And how does that play into it? It's not entirely clear. It's a really complicated subject, and it's hard to get your head around.
Okay, other comments?
Well, I guess the good news is that it looks like the proposal is going to include a recalculation of the contract high water mark, which is something I think that we're strongly in favor of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my comments are coming at the cost side of things. I participated in, they started their integrated program review workshops last week. There's about, six or seven of them, and I participated in the hydropower and fish and wildlife and one over the one. And what's interesting here is that, and I also participated in the strategic asset management plan workshop the week before. And while neither one of these things are, quote, 2028 process initiatives, like the 2028 process, they're separate tracks that BPA's got, and yet they have a direct bearing on what we need to know to make a reasonable decision about which way to go with 2028 contracts. So notably, in the hydropower IPR, they had Bonneville gave a pitch, then the Corps gave a pitch, and Bureau of Reclamation gave a pitch. And in the narratives by both Bureau and the Corps, they talked a lot about their cost drivers on various subjects, whether it's equipment, supply items, labor. They're all going up at, 5, 10, 15, 20% a year, annual increases, depending on the category, like electricians are like 20% or something in the core. And at the same time, though, Bonneville is showing a chart. There was one that was particularly interesting. They called it the fully loaded cost chart. It showed from 2022 to 2042, the various cost categories of the hydro system, and it basically is flatlined across 20 years. And they did that by holding everything in 2022 dollars, which, you know, I'm not an economist, so when I see that kind of stuff, I scratch my head and say, what are they doing here? And one of the WAPAG staff folks, too, had the same kind of concern. And also, BPA is holding their O&M escalation at about 2%, which, again, is well below the narratives that you got from the Corps of Engineers and Bureau of Reclamation. So you got that piece of it. And then there's the capital expenditures piece, which, you know, is basically flatlined at just under $300 million for the out years. And it's and they say because, well, anyway, one of the interesting things they say about it is that increases in capital investments are offset by mitigation loss generation. So what they're saying is they're going to hold down capital expenditures in anticipation of some loss generation. And the mitigation is like what Rick's saying, is they're going to go out to the secondary market to get it. And so that's one aspect of this. But you have to break for a minute and go back to what Elliot Meinzer 4 years ago during the days of the bloodbath discussion said, was worried. And in fact, Robert, this guy from Energy Northwest said it last week in his presentation to WAPAG, is that Elliot was scared to death that PUD is going to walk away from the 2028 contracts because of the arise, this just constant increase in cost at BPA. And so he was, you know, getting rid of everything from corporate airplanes to holding capital expenditures low. And so he's done that. And so, okay, fine. We've had, you know, relatively stable rates cases and so forth. And, you know, the IRP that, you know, we're starting now for the 24-25 rate case is going to look good too. And so he's, you know, and Harrison's following the same model so far. And so we've got two rate cases in a row where things are being suppressed in terms of capital expenditures. So this means that, you know, turbine rehabs, replacements, rewinds, and all those big ticket items are getting pushed off further into the future. And of course, the strategy here is to push them off far enough that they don't cause any alarm bells to go off in the PUD community before we sign these 2028 contracts in, what, 2025. Now, so you got that going on. And then you look at the strategic asset management plan, and that's an interesting issue going on there because, of course, they've done asset management on thousands of widgets and so forth, but they still don't do it. They're still squirrely about whether they're actually doing it at the project level. And one of the things they did do, though, was provide a chart that showed the relative value of the dams across the federal hydro system. And if you can imagine, in the far right corner was the big hydro projects of high value and high generation revenues and so forth, and high risk if you lose them. And up there, of course, were the units at Grand Coulee and Chief Joseph. And then as you came down to the lower left, you ran into the Mid-Columbia dams, and then you ran into the lower Snake dams. Then off to the left is the, you know, like Willamette dams and so forth, these really area support projects that don't do anything. And so what they're doing in the asset management plan, though, is reinforcing this, which is a good idea, is put your money on the most important projects. And that's, of course, Grand Coulee. And then, as I said, it tapers on down to the left. That makes sense for capital expenditures. But what they're not doing is looking at all the other costs associated with all those other dams, the O&M and so forth. It's also, you know, like, and they show that, you know, lower Snake dams are running about $200 million in revenue, but about $240 million in expenses. And so you get this picture that they are they're going to, you know, put their priority on capital expenditures on the high value project. That makes sense. But they're letting all these other ones just sit there. And this is starting to raise some concern in some of the folks I've talked to in the associations and so forth. And they see this too going on as, well, wait a minute, when are the chickens coming home to roost on this thing? Because eventually you're going to get at a point 4 or 5 years where you've got, you know, major failures.
And there's no plan, there's no money to put it back into operation. And so you're basically redlining or running generators and turbines and such to failure. And so that is something that I think we need to be paying attention to as well as we go into this 28-28 contract. And what was interesting is very few people said anything during the IPR discussion on hydropower. They just accepted it. And I thought that was, you know, what's going on here? Don't they realize what's happening here? And I don't know. I think that, you know, that's what BPA's strategy is. And we've got to look at that hard. And I know, I know WAPTAG folks are, you know, would like to drill more into that. It's just, how do you do it? That's one comment I have. Any feedback or thought on that? Staff? Okay, the other one is Energy Northwest at the WAPAG meeting. This relates to the same thing, but it's something that we're being asked to make a decision on this now. And what's his name? Robert, CEO of Energy Northwest.
Bob Schutz.
Yeah, thanks. He gave a, you know, very slick presentation, you know, very high level presentation on the need, the perceived need to do this to increase the capacity of those of that generator, and what it would cost and so forth, and how it would be paid for, and how it compared to other sorts of like renewables. And I thought, well, okay, fine. And then the question was, well, what does BPA say? Well, BPA doesn't want to address this right now. They, you know, have got a price tag of $31 million to look at this thing. But we already know, based on the comments we're hearing from Energy Northwest and others, is that BPA is still kind of a little, maybe not 100% sold on this, but wanted input. Well, if the PUDs want to do it, well, maybe we will. And so they're coming to us. And I think that's kind of maybe unfair, because do we have the analytical abilities to really, you know, look at all the details about this thing in light of other potential resources? And I asked the question about, well, how does this affect, what does it really mean in terms of the tier one rate right now? What kind of effect is it on that? Now, they say they're going to save money, which I don't argue with it, that on the Hanford system, on Columbia Generating Plant, it will save money. But what are we saving? Are we saying it's already an expensive asset? And so, okay, we're reducing, it's less expensive, but it's still more expensive than the tier one rate. Now, I asked for what number that would be, and Robert said he didn't really know. We should ask BPA, and BPA is saying ask you guys. So I don't, and WAPAG's looking for us to provide a response by the 15th, and I honestly don't think, I personally don't have enough information to make that decision, but I would like to know what the staff thinks, or the other two commissioners, you know, what your view of this is.
Well, basically, the $31 million is to continue, you know, like anything with the nuclear business, we've got to go back to the NRC, amend our license. We've got to provide a huge amount of data and studies to do that. So, and all of that costs money. Plus, go to the vendors and collaborate with them as far as uprating different items of equipment. The big dollar items would be rewinding the generator and the high pressure turbine. But this is not approval of the uprate. This is approval of just continuing the study. And, you know, this would be tier one. Any uprate additional at 170 megawatts would be tier one, which will add to, would augment the existing tier one system. Plus, it may add to secondary sales as well.
Staff took a back of the napkin analysis, and unfortunately, the analysis that PPC and others are doing is probably heavily dependent upon secondary sales, assumptions of market conditions and even assumptions of what rate on tax exempt bonds you could get. And there's no way for staff to actually do anything without pulling numbers out of the air. But we did do just a timeline of money. And if you look at the expenditures and you look at the revenue, you can set a value on the dollars per megawatt hour. And if the plant runs through 2043, that dollar amount, assuming, let's say, a 4% rate on tax-exempt bonds, is going to be in the upper 30s, $38, $39 average megawatt hour. If you take the operation of the plant through 2063 with a 20-year extension, you're probably going to bring the price down to below $30 an average megawatt hour. And one could say an honest evaluation is, yes, it's higher than the existing Tier 1 rate, and it's in the ballpark of what the Tier 2 rate would be, which is kind of a way of looking at that as saying, yes, this would be moving Tier 1 into Tier 2, or replacing what would have otherwise been Tier 2 with Tier 1. So, yeah, $39 is about what we expect the rate of power for the BP24. And under those circumstances, running to 2043, it's kind of a wash. But once again, that's just making gross simplifications, just looking at the timeline of money. If it were to run until 2063, if we knew that or had a high expectation, I would call it a no-brainer. It will definitely pay for itself and be advantageous. But we can't predict what secondary sales are, nor what the market looks like, or you know, be comfortable with the wide swings we're seeing in the market.
But supposedly, even without the subsequent license extension or renewal, this will pay out if the license is not extended. You know, what drives this is in the Bonneville's IPR that Energy Northwest requested the $31 million to continue looking at this and fine-tune it. And they didn't make it into the IPR. So the Executive Board of Energy Northwest crafted a letter, sent it to John Harrison. Actually, I had dinner with John Harrison down in Portland, and we talked about this issue. And it all falls back to shifting responsibility. Bonneville wants public power to provide some driver for this. And so this is what WAPEG's effort's all about. That's the reason Bob Schutz went and made the presentation to WAPEG.
Yeah, so in the meeting, there was a lot of feedback on it, and a lot of utilities said were favorable towards it, it looked like. But, staff, unless the board directs us one way or the other, would not make a comment unless we're given guidance from the board, whether that's to be opposed, in favor of, or simply to make no comment at all, because WAPEG asked for feedback, and it looked like most utilities were generally favorable.
Yeah, and PPC is supporting this as well. You know, it all comes back to resource adequacy, that an upgrade of Columbia seems to be the low-cost addition that can augment Tier 1.
Well, yeah. But think of what I just said about capital expenditures. They don't even want to invest what they need to in the hydro system, which is supposedly cheaper, which, grand coolly, it is. So it just pulls your hair out thinking, well, wait a minute. And the reason they don't, this is because we're not stacking these assets up and comparing them. We don't know the cost for each one. And until you do that, we're just sort of making sort of assumptions about what the impacts are one way or the other, whether it's a good deal to go with this way or that way or so forth. And so I don't know. My view is we don't make a comment, but it because we're just running on the information here is piecemeal.
Well, given CETA and the loss of thermal generation in the region, I'm supportive of increasing a carbon-free Bonneville resource.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, it is base load 24/7. We'll back up renewables and kind of meets the criteria that we normally look for at Hydro. So what are you looking for here, Sean? You need a motion on this or what?
I just need direction from the board if we're going to support the $31 million so I can respond back to Ryan.
Okay. Well, I support it. Sounds like Rick does.
Yes.
I'm sort of, I guess.
Well, you're right, Jim. This thing is being studied to death. We're kind of into analysis paralysis right now. But we do need the $31 million, and that's the issue really on the table, is to continue looking at this. And you know, then when all of it gels towards the end, then we'll have another opportunity to say, well, that's a good idea or not. So,
well, given that, I move that we support the $31 million that's being requested for additional studies on the expansion of WMP2.
Well, I abstain.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the Columbia Generating Station uprate study financing of $31 million, if I've stated that correctly. And I will call for the vote. I'll vote aye.
Aye.
Abstain.
Aye. Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Jim. Okay, what's next here?
Wait, I have one other thing.
Okay.
I also listened in to the WAPUTA's strategic plan workshop last week. It was scheduled for 2 hours, and it was over like in 25 minutes. In fact, I had to drag it out to get an extra 10 in there. One of the things that I note, and it'll be brought up at the WAPUTA meeting, though, is that the way it's written, it in the principles in the beginning, it has a statement that sort of sounds like they're saying that WAPUTA is neutral on technology in terms of, you know, basically we want the lowest cost, most reliant technology. Okay, great. But then later on, they have a couple bullets where they say we want to promote and protect hydropower. And in another one, it says we want to promote and protect the nuclear stuff. Well, you know, that's fine, except they don't say anything about renewables. And I think that's either disingenuous or, you know, we either don't have those bullets that say we support, and, you know, you just stick with we want to get the least cost, best technology to support our power and leave all these promote stuff off, or either add renewables in there too. Anyway, that's just my observation, the strategic plan. Since I'm not a member of any of the committees that were in that discussion, I didn't make a comment, but that's just my observation.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Okay, we'll move on to correspondence and communication. Sean, do we have any?
Nothing today, sir.
Okay, good. All right, commissioner reports. Jim, you want to lead us off? I think we've talked about a lot of things that's happened, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's everything. I guess the only, let me double check my notes here. Unless in the high watermark process, Sean or John, they presented a chart that shows the forecast of all the PUDs, and graph shows us dropping in load. Is that consistent with your analysis? And is that what you've told WAPAC?
Yeah, so basically our end of the proposed increase in contract high water marks, I don't know if it was a actual reduction or tier two obligation is going down because we're effectively being allocated more tier one. That's my understanding.
Are you just talking the next rate case, Jim? Is that chart that he showed for the next rate case?
Where was that?
I believe it was. It was imperative for the next rate case.
Yeah.
And our obligation was over four, or expected to be 4 to 5 average megawatts, and it went down to like 1.4 something.
Yeah, I was going to say right at 1.5, but 1.4, 1.5, somewhere in there.
but our allocation of tier one was previously down to like 72, and now that went up. So I don't think they showed a decrease in load. I thought they showed it fairly flat. But I'll be honest with you, you know, the COVID impacts, you know, BPA, there's a lot of load out there that they're still thinking is temporary and may not be.
That's all I have.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Rick?
Yes. Bob Schultz had some interesting information, I thought. He said that the cost for the region to get to 90% carbon free would increase power rates by $20 a megawatt hour. To get to 96%, I believe he said it was about $25 to $26 a megawatt hour increase. And to get to 100% carbon free would be a $30 per megawatt hour increase in current rates. Now, I sent an email to Ryan to clarify, to make sure that that was only on the power side, and I believe it is. And as I've stated in the past, a lot of additional costs are going to be on the transmission side, because a lot of the solar and – or the proposed solar and wind farms are out where there is no transmission. And my fear is that to build all the transmission and get those things approved, I think we're going to run into a lot of NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Yeah.
I've already seen a number of articles from Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon where they're saying, no, you're not going to put solar on all this land because we don't want you to do that. Or you can't build the transmission to move that power. So it looks to me like moving forward that there's going to be an increased dependence on the hydro system with because of CETA and because of potential or projected load growth, and that the adding the new resources is going to be very, very expensive. And I think there's going to be a lot of sticker shock going forward once people start seeing what it costs to try to bring in the renewable generation to the grid. That's all I got.
Yeah, I heard that too, and I like, okay, so what's his basis for that analysis? Because, you know, of course, the Power Planning Council, you know, they didn't say that, and with all their modeling and so forth. So what I see is just it's another contradiction in terms of where prices are headed on everything.
I think what Bob Schultz was saying was aligned with the E3 study that was done a couple of years ago, that getting that last bit of carbon out of the system would be very expensive.
Well, sure. But, you know, it's the bulk of it is what you're after.
Well, no. Zero carbon is what we're after, Jim.
Yeah, you should read the law.
Yeah. So anyway, Energy Northwest Executive Board met in Portland on the 22nd, 23rd. We do that once a year so we can interface with Bonneville. We invite Bonneville to participate. We had a great turnout. John Harrison was there, as well as six or eight other executives from Bonneville. So we got to lobby Bonneville. Under the CEO report, they've executed all the labor contracts with the exception of the security force, and they're always kind of a hard nut to crack, so they're in mediation there. We received, Energy Northwest received a economic dispatch request from Bonneville that they would reduce power output of the Columbia Generating Station to 40%. They did that, but they only did it for a week. That's because of all the water in the system. There was a discussion about spent fuel. You know, we've got 54 concrete canisters on site parked on a 12-foot thick pad. We're always adding to that, mainly because there's no repository for spent fuel. And the discussion kind of centered around that, well, you know, if you could reprocess this fuel like they do in Europe and other countries, that would alleviate some of that problem. You know, we only get about a third of the energy out of the uranium unless you do reprocess it. That started a prohibition on reprocessing, started back with Jimmy Carter back in the, whenever Jimmy Carter was around, I've forgotten. But anyway, so we talked about that, and but having said that, the uranium right now is pretty cheap. Now, it's going to go up in price, but it's kind of prohibitive to reprocess fuel. On the advanced reactor front, this is where DOE is funding $2 billion for an advanced reactor. These are the SMRs. X Energy, of course, we're working with Grant, PUD. They're looking at two technologies, NuScale, which is the Oregon State technology, and X Energy, which is the high-temperature gas cool graphite-moderated gumball reactors. They are, they've more or less settled on X Energy. And part of that was that X Energy was, we were advocating for Site 1, which is right next door to Columbia. And X Energy was funding that study and the licensing process with the Department of Energy. But now that funding will go away. Now, talking to Hairston, there's still some interest in Bonneville doing an SMR, and so we're the DOE portion of that licensing for that site will continue, and so hopefully it might be used in the future. We talked about in the past HALEU, which is high assay, low enriched uranium that the SMRs require, and one development on that the Navy, from their nuclear reserves, is making uranium fuel available for HALEU production. It's kind of limited, but at least that will alleviate some of the problems that that we see going into the SMR thing. Let's see, I can abbreviate this a bit. Yeah, the Inslee Patty Murray study on the Snake River dams came back, and The governing statement seems to be that all risk need to be mitigated before breaching, and including in that to replace the generation for the Snake River dams. The chief nuclear officer gave a report, 191 days online. Kind of interesting. Exelon, which is one of the biggest nuclear plant operators in the country, they changed their name to Constellation. And now they're calling their nuclear plants clean energy centers. So that's kind of a PR move, I would think. EVITA, it's the electric vehicle infrastructure for transportation arm of Energy Northwest. They've got funding, and they're building charging stations along Highway 12. They've applied for grants to build charging stations over the 101 loop, which would be mostly here in Fallon County. These would be fast chargers, and that would really help with tourism as well as local people who want to go with the EVs. We also we lost two executive board members, Linda Goss and Mason 3, she's retiring. She's not going to run for her commission seat again either. Since she's moving to Montana, we kind of said, well, spend one winter up there and you probably will be back. But anyway, then Skip Olser, who was the nuclear expert and has been on the executive board since 2010, about the same time I have, and he's decided to not continue. So we gave them a good send-off, and we have a new nuclear expert that's joining the board, Bill Potesa, and he's very qualified. He's given presentations to the executive board, so I think he'll be a good good one to backfill that position. I guess that's enough. Any questions, comments? Okay, good. All right, staff reports. Update on Carlsberg UGA water rights. Tom Martin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'd like to give you an update on the memorandum of understanding for Carlsberg. That's between the district and Collin County. So I'm going to share my screen here. And that one. Let's see. Okay, can you see that screen right now?
Yes, sir.
Title slide, thank you. Well, the actual intent of the memorandum of agreement of understanding with the county is that we have to show public interest, strong public interest, in order to pass a test with ecology for getting our water right. It's one of a four-part test, public interest. And so the strongest statement that we can make to public interest is that the district and the county show unity. That is the strongest showing of public interest. And so the draft MOU is intended to show the understanding of each other's interests, both our individual interests and our shared interests. Now, some, but not all, of our interests are shared. That's fine. And ecology also has to be brought into this. So we have to share ecology's interests. They will be making the final approval. So the next step after the MOU with all of our interests in it is to create as many possible options to meet our common interests. So that's where we're heading with this. So from the latest update with all the comments back and forth from the county and the district, here are what it boils down to, our primary interests. So the county's primary objective here is to secure the district's commitment to extend our retail service area for water to the entire UGA and do that now. And the county actually rejected a district suggestion that that we would provide water outside of the UGA. In other words, for example, to the Squim Valley Airport and make that on equal footing with service in the UGA. So, and the county seems to be giving lower priority to water quality of existing and water and future water supplies than they are to expanding the UGA and, you know, or expanding the service area to cover the whole UGA. And that's mostly being driven by, you know, housing concerns. And so the district's priority, our number one priority, is providing safe drinking water and to our existing customers and to protect the LUD Pioneers water rights. So back in February, the county was offering funding, but that was conditioned upon meeting their primary objective, expanding the UGA now. And that really did not acknowledge our interests here. So we took a step back and we said, okay, that was a draft agreement from the county that really didn't look at all the interests. So I said, okay, let's put them all into one document first. Let's get our interests all lined up so that we can go forward from there. So, and also to put in ecology's interest, because like I said, that's part of a four-part test for approving a water right. And so ecology's public interest tests really should be setting the priorities for the district and the county. And so as part of meeting the public interest test, ecology says we need the district and the county needs to come up with a regional plan for water supply in the Carlsberg region to prevent the proliferation of exempt wells. That's their biggest thing. They would prefer that everybody hook up to a PUD water system, to a Group A water system, and that's okay with us, obviously.
Give us
but we need water rights to do that.
We will go.
So, and then there's the water right development schedule. Okay, so how long is it going to take to build out the LUD and the UGA? And we're looking at, you know, possibly 40 to 60 years. So ecology wants to know, well, how are we going to expand during that time period? So that's the primary interest, what it boils down to.
Tom, can I go ahead and ask a question?
Sure. You're kind of quiet.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I had my mic down below my chin.
That's perfect.
This statement on water quality,
mm-hmm,
that the county puts lower priority on drinking water standards are pretty well mandated. What are we talking about there?
We're talking about the nitrate issue.
Okay, all right. So just specifically that then.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Welcome. So while we're working on the MOU, there's a parallel track of another effort that's equally important, if not maybe more important, to getting the water right, and that is to get ecology to approve our mitigation plan for our new water right application. And that's been going on. You know, we met back in March and presented the plan to them, to ecology back then. And, you know, they basically got back to us in late May, in June, saying, well, we need to present this plan to everybody, local stakeholders, so that ecology can get their feedback. So we did that. On June 17th, we had a meeting here at the PUD on a Friday, and this meeting was actually called by ecology, so they pretty much ran the meeting. And so there's a local water resource technical group that is part of the Dungeness River management team. And so the technical group were the experts from the different shareholders groups represented in the DRMT. And ecology wanted to, you know, run the technical details of using aquifer 4, you know, the deep aquifer that the new well is drilled to, and get the comments pro and con on using aquifer 4, and you know, in reaching out like this, the ecology was actually assessing the risk of a possible appeal of their pending water right decision. So, you know, they Mike Gallagher of Ecology basically told me, look, I don't want to go through writing a whole record of a decision and that whole effort and then just to have it appealed immediately. I just want to know what we need to address in our decision making. So at the meeting, the consultant from the county, the hydrogeologist, Robinson Noble, presented the plan. And those who are making comments from this water resource technical group were the Jamestown Skyland Tribe, the City of Sequim, the Audubon Society, the Clown Conservation District, and Marty Lang, who is the owner of a lot where the well was drilled, because, you know, he wants to build 27 units or lots out using this water supply. So much to my delight, ecology seemed to support the mitigation plan and the build-out schedule and how we plan on expanding service area first using our existing water rate, and then shifting that production from our existing well to the new well to provide the mitigation and mitigation for new water rights. So that is an adaptive management technique that Ecology acknowledged and that the tribe was very interested in seeing happen. They wanted adaptive management for this because it's such a long-term thing. You know, it's 40 to 60 years. It's several generations to plan for. And let's adapt as we go along. And Ecology was saying, well, you know, this mitigation plan does that. So that was really good to hear. And so the follow-up is to, you know, have to get back with Mike Gallagher from Ecology and say, okay, here are the comments. And the Jamestown Squalum tribe, when I talked to them earlier in the week, they said, well, they have yet to discuss internally, but they actually came back to me later, like yesterday, and said, we should have our comments by August. So, you know, we're looking at Ecology having a lot more information from the local stakeholders, and hopefully moving forward with that to make their decision. So I'm eagerly awaiting those comments.
Tom, you were talking about the full build-out and it taking 40 to 60 years.
Uh-huh.
I'm confused. When you say build-out, do you mean all the end users in place, or could you explain what you mean by the full build-out?
Yeah, sure. It's a very, very exact technique that we use to determine what the water demand would be when the current, all the lots that are with their current zoning are built out to their maximum density. All right. So the county has the zoning. They went through their zoning. This is actually an estimate that the county provided, that they estimate. They used their geographic information system to look at each lot, what their zoning was, what's the maximum dwelling unit density. They counted them all up for the residential and the commercial zones, and then they applied a factor of, you know, well, how much water per day does, an effect, you know, equivalent residential unit use. And, you know, that's from our meter data. And so that's where we came up with, oh, we need 261 acre feet more water right in order to meet the full build out. So that's called it's kind of a saturation analysis. If we, you know, saturate the whole area by building out to the maximum density of all the zoning. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and then presented another one. Does that include when you say full build out, we had proposed providing water all the way out to the airport, which it really isn't part of the UGA.
Mm-hmm.
So that full build out, is that just for the UGA, or does it include the extra area that you had talked about?
I am going to talk about that in a little bit. I've got another couple slides, but the full build out is primarily the UGA, right?
Okay.
And I'll hold that thought. I'll get right back to it. Here is that area that we were just referring to, Rick, in that area outside, including the airport, outside of the UGA. So this map shows yellow shaded areas, blue and green, and then there's an outline in red. Well, that outlined area in red is the UGA. The yellow areas show our current local utility districts, our current retail service area. The blue areas show where we don't have a service right now within the UGA. And then the green area outside, well, that's an area that's approximately a half a mile away from the end of our distribution system. If we were going to serve outside the UGA, which is an interest of Ecology. You know, that's part of the regional plan that they're talking about. And so if we went out further from the UGA to service areas out there in order to prevent the proliferation of exempt wells, this is about as far as we could go given our current water rate capacity and our ability to mitigate. If this mitigation plan goes through, then, yeah, I think we can serve that that green area. It's all contingent on getting that mitigation plan approved. So what are our options here for expanding? We can continue with our existing policy that we formally adopted in 2017, which, you know, the policy says get the water rights first and then we'll expand our service area. And that preserves our existing water rights for the pioneers. So the expansion would be contingent upon getting the mitigation plan approved and then thus, you know, after that, the water rate approved. And then, you know, we have to reiterate that our full build-out analysis shows, you know, the LUD having so much demand in the UGA and then revisit the original intent of the service area and the changes over time. So this is the first time I've introduced this original intent phrase. And it's something that ecology uses when they're talking about public interest tests. It's like when we originally applied for the water right back in 1990, you know, we had this much larger area that we intended to serve in addition to the UGA. So, you know, we have to just really go back and say, okay, well, we are now in a much different situation here in with our build-out scenario than we were in 1990. There's a UGA which wasn't formed back then. So that's staying with our original policy, making sure that we get water rights first. Now, then the second option is what's called a phase extension of infrastructure. And that expansion is contingent upon getting the mitigation approval, not necessarily the full water right, but at least the mitigation plan approval so that we have an ability and an approval in writing from ecology that says any mitigation that we generate can be used to get new water rights later. And also developing a regional water supply to control the exempt wells. Well, part of that control of this exempt wells has to do with the county's action that are required here. They would have to use their land use authority to regulate the proliferation of exempt wells. And so this is the thought. If we're going to expand without getting all the water rights, just the mitigation plan approved, we would require, or the county would require connection to the district's water system now or maybe later. For now, maybe temporarily, we would allow developers to put in an exempt well, but require them to abandon that well when it becomes feasible to connect to the district, when main extensions go out to that area. And just like any of our main extensions, the developers would be required to fund the expansion, you know, pay for the main extension as well as the abandonment of an exempt well that they put in temporarily. So, you know, we would be able to kind of loosen up on our requirements of our formal policy if the county took this step. So, yeah, let's just go back and revisit, you know, we have a certain amount of water rights right now, and we can compare that to the full build-out demand. So what we have right now is 468.5 acre-feet of water rights. And the full build-out demand is just for the LUD is 482. So we are short by 13.84. We don't have enough water rights right now to reserve for the full build out. We need more. And so if we're just looking, this is the original service area in 1991. Now, this is a map that Mike Kitts drew and submitted to the Department of Ecology. And it's an old map, as you can see. But there's Highway 101 kind of running right through here. This is the Carlsberg area. And so this is a much larger area that goes out to Woodcock Road, past Kitchen Dick, all the way out to the Agnew area, to where the strait is, and then down to along Atterbury Road kind of thing, and all the way over to the Dungeness River. So back then it was contemplated that the original LUD would only have 225 connections, and you know, plus school and some commercial light industrial. That was the idea back in 1990. And the population back then was 3,500 in this whole area. This is a 15-square-mile area that we're talking about. And so back in 1990, they predicted 20 years of growth at 4%. We'd get up to 8,000 population in this area. And so we said that in our application that we want to serve this LUD, but we're going to probably expand sooner or later to have another 1,500 customers beyond the original 225 by 2011. So Ecology, when they saw this, when they asked about, well, what's your service area going to be, they actually approved 1,500 connections for all customer types, residential, commercial, industrial. So that was the original intent. Now, what happened since then, like I said, the UGA was formed. And I've shown you this diagram before. And it's like, okay, what's the – now, these numbers are in units of equivalent residential units. So this is the UGA. It overlaps with the LUD. So the original intent, we asked for 1,500 connections. Well, right now – we are only at 449, and that's you know, roughly 20% of our water rate that we're using right now. But the build out shows that the LUD number of connections is going to be 2,412, and if you add the LUD plus the expansion of into the rest of the UGA, we're looking at 3,644 ERUs. That is more than twice the amount of was contemplated for the number of connections from 1990. So we're showing a much – this is all showing that we need to reserve our water rights for our pioneers. And even though we're only using 20% now, if we keep giving water away, well, you know, we won't have enough for later. Now, but you know, how does that equate to serving outside? Well, you know, outside of the UGA, because there were some questions from the last meeting that were brought up by the public that said, well, wait a second, I heard about this plan to serve outside of the UGA, and I have property inside the UGA that's not being served right now. I've been waiting a long time. I want to get served first. Why are you even thinking about going out to the airport? And so what I had in mind here was, now we have a mitigation plan that Ecology is looking at favorably, and it's going to adapt over time with the growth as it occurs. And so the potential mitigation that we have with our existing water rate, if we shift the entire production from the existing well in Carlsberg, right in the industrial park there, over to the new well at the end of Carlsberg Road to the deep aquifer, we have enough mitigation to cover the new water that's required for full build out, plus some more. And that's what these calculations show. Basically, you know, we have a LUD-10 water rate, and this is the amount of, you know, 1,820 ERUs. If we shift all that over, and we get 1,827 ERUs for new, and then we have a Smithfield water right, which is on Smithfield Road. We have some wells over there. So the total water right and mitigation is 3,978. The total full build-out demand is 3,644. We have 334 ERUs of mitigation potential beyond, you know, mitigating the full build-out of the UGA. So I thought, wow, we can use that to expand our service area to satisfy ecology's interest in preventing the proliferation of exempt wells. And we can only do that to a certain extent. We can't serve that whole 15 square mile area that we had contemplated back in 1990, but we certainly can serve an area that's within maybe a half a mile of our existing distribution system and the airport, which is a little further away. Now, you know, I'm going to have to get more details on, you know, work with the county on finding out, well, which ones are, you know, of this area is reserved for agriculture and what could be developed and broken up into smaller lots. But, or use cluster development, say, instead, you know, I think we can refine this map, but this is a first step. This is a first shot, and just trying to get the concept out there so the county can understand where I'm coming from with this and what kind of mitigation potential we have. Now, this is all well and good if we assume that the mitigation plan and the water rights going to be approved by ecology. However, let's be a little pessimistic here for a second and say, well, what if the mitigation plan is not approved? What if, you know, using the existing water rate for mitigation is not an option? Well, what happens? The nitrate issue does not go away. The water quality issue just keeps getting worse. We got a little bit better results this year than last year. We sampled every May, and it was the first time in 10 years where we didn't have an increase in the nitrates. That was really gives us some hope, but we have to measure again in October because that's our compliance month. And so, you know, I'm looking at the trend of increase over the past 10 years of nitrate and saying, oh boy, we need to treat this. We have a treatment system in place by 2026. I was saying 2025 before we got the May results back, but I think that might give us an extra year to build this thing. So we build a treatment system. So we may not get the water right approved, but we still have to deal with the water quality and treating the nitrates. That is our primary interest here at the district. I think we should still proceed with the blending treatment project and only have that project serve the existing retail service area and continue to protect the water rights for the pioneers. So that is a tough point for the county, because, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is expanding the UGA and getting new water rights to the mitigation plan. And if we expand like this, that mitigation potential might go away. And that would be a very unfortunate outcome of this. And I hope we're trying to impress that upon ecology and everybody else, all the local stakeholders, that, you know, this water quality is really our primary interest.
Tom, I've got questions for you. One, the nitrate issue, is that associated with fertilizer and or not. And the second question has to do with, I thought that if the mitigation plan was accepted, then the water rights was pretty much a foregone conclusion. Am I mistaken in that?
Okay, so you've got two questions. Let me address the first one on the nitrate source you're talking about. Yeah, fertilizer can be a source of nitrates, and leaking septic tanks. And so the difficulty is trying to pinpoint where the source is. And, you know, for a very long time, the county has been reluctant on doing any kind of modeling or studies. You know, they did some data collection back in the 90s that showed, in the 2000s, which showed, you know, some pretty hot spots in and around Carlsberg. And our sampling, our annual sampling for compliance with the Department of Health, it showed an increase. But, without a real detailed study and monitoring program to go with it, it's tough to say exactly what the source is. The sewer, when it was put in, is a source control measure. And for the septic tanks, and yet we still have an increase in nitrates even after the sewer was built. So there are some places that are not sewered, that are not compelled by law to connect to the sewer, and they're within the UGA. And I think it would be important for those developments to hook up eventually, but there's nothing we can do legally at this point. The second question now, the second was in regards to
the mitigation plan that.
I understand. Yeah, the mitigation. Yeah, it's generally a done deal. You mitigate first, and then you get the water second. In the water rights second, it should follow pretty closely, but there's no guarantee, you know. So there may be an option where, you know, we get the mitigation plan approved, but ecology says, well, we'll give you a water right so you can have this mitigation mechanism in there, but we're not going to give you any annual allocation. You wait till you use 80% of your water rate and then we'll think about it. But it's like, okay, well, that's fine, but at least let us build up mitigation in the meantime.
You had also proposed or talked about a mixing plant to help address the nitrate issue. And I guess my question there would be, have we compared the cost of trying to track down where the nitrates are coming from as compared to this mixing plant, and which would be the most cost effective?
Well, we could see where the nitrates are coming from, but we still need a way to control them, you know. So we are comparing this mixing or blending treatment system with other options, like just building a nitrate treatment plant. And the operation maintenance of a treatment plant versus just a blending system where you mix two water from two sources together in a tank is much lower. You know, the operation maintenance costs much lower for blending. So in the long run, this would be the cheaper alternative. Going around and trying to chase down all the nitrate sources and say cease and desist. I'm not sure how that's going to come out.
Sounds like a headache, but I thought I'd throw it out there.
Okay. Well, good questions. Any others?
Well, Tom, I thought one of the selling points for the sewer system was to address nitrates from septic tanks, and I know the fertilizer issue is out there as well. But, even if you connect people to the sewer system, Wouldn't it take years for the septic tanks to for nitrates from those sources to go away?
Well, it appears like that's what's happening. In addition to, there are some others that are not connected that have septic systems.
So you might be faced with having to go around and pump all those septic tanks. I don't know. Anyway, I'm trying to problem solve here.
Yeah. Well, you know, this year we've had a lot of water running through the system with all the rain in the spring.
Yeah.
So that may have been the reason why maybe we got our nitrates didn't increase this year because they got diluted by a lot of rain and river water. So I'm very interested to see what happens in October when we sample that.
Well, as I understand what you're advocating here, it still protects the pioneers.
Yes.
Okay. That's kind
of we're living within our means to mitigate and get new mitigate for new water.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. That was a good presentation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was great. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thanks, Tom. Okay, board action items. T, did you capture any?
Yes, staff is to respond to Bethany Rondeau's email correspondence regarding meter hookup fees.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right, comments from the public.
Yes, if anyone has any public comment they would like to give at this time, please raise your hand or state your name.
Okay, hearing none.
Yes, hearing none.
Our next item is an executive session. So we will recess our meeting and go into executive session to discuss litigation or potential litigation with legal counsel pursuant to RCW's 42.30.110, section LI.
Okay, well, I'm going to pause recording now, and give me a few minutes. I have to put everyone in the waiting room.
Just real quick before you pause recording, T, I expect 20 minutes and no action.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so hold on. I'm going to pause right now, and then I'll put everyone in the waiting room except those in the executive session, and I'll let you know when that it has been done.
If it's any consolation, we discussed with Jamie and Sean, and I think a year from now, this is going to be something the other party will regret.
Yep.
For your help.
Thank you, Dave.
I don't think, Sean, Jamie, I don't think you need me anymore.
No, I'm going to give you a call afterwards.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We've reconvened our normal meeting. And there's no other business to come before the commission. We are adjourned.
Thank you, commissioners. Have a good afternoon.
Okay, same to you.
Same.
Yeah, goodbye, everybody.